Hi, and welcome back to New Books in Middle Eastern Studies. Today, I have with me Marie Grace Brown, who is assistant professor at the University of Kansas, where she is also affiliated with the Kansas African Studies Center. She received her bachelor's degree at Bryn Mawr College and her doctorate at the University of Pennsylvania. She identifies as a cultural historian of the modern Middle East with a special interest in empire, gender, and the body as historical text. Brown's work has been supported by grants from the American Association of University Women, the Social Science Research Council, and the Woodrow Wilson National Fellowship Foundation. She is the author of several articles and a new book, out 2017 from Stanford University Press, Khartoum at Night, Fashion and Body Politics in Imperial Sudan. Welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
No, it's congratulations on the book. It was a pleasure to read.
Thank you. Thank you. It was sometimes a pleasure to write.
So, we always start off with a bit of an intellectual biography question, sort of, how did you come to the study of Sudan? How did you come to write the book?
Yeah, and I think it's sometimes dangerous to ask historians those questions, because we could go back, you know, pretty far into our own history about how we got started. But how I came to Sudan was by accident, as I think a lot of projects are. I entered graduate school with an interest in Egypt in the mid-20th century. And while taking a graduate seminar on North Africa, you know, I just sort of thought, well, I'll just write a seminar paper about Sudan and just, you know, why not do something a little bit different? And it was incredible just sort of how little information was out there. So it felt like this wide open field in which you could sort of really play around and ask any number of questions, because so few scholars in the United States, and I would even extend this to England in some ways, work on Sudan, and certainly on Sudanese women. There was just really a dearth of information. So that piqued my interest. I spent a lot of time thinking about women's activism in Sudan, and that was what my dissertation was about. But there were all these references, kind of throwaway references to fashion and the body. Reading memoirs of different activists, and they would say, we attended this protest and we all wore our national costume, or I was able to go to school because I was wearing this particular type of dress. And those references just kind of started piling up. And I thought, wow, like the story here seems to really be about what women are wearing and how they're moving their bodies. And that seemed to sort of really be part of the imperial experience about growing up, coming of age, defining what it meant to be a woman. It all sort of fell together in the past couple of years, right? That this was that what I was looking at was a body story, a story about an intimate experience of empire. And so that's what I've attempted to do in the book, is tell the story of the British imperial rule in Sudan, so sort of doing that whole sort of sweep from 1898 to 1956, from a woman's perspective, but a perspective that was very much about empire being an embodied experience.
So to take a step back, Sudan is really difficult to place geographically and culturally. I'm actually really surprised that you wrote a paper on Sudan in a North African studies or history seminar, because I remember when I took a North African history seminar in grad school last year, we didn't touch Sudan. I think the closest we got to Sudan was when we talked about the trans-Saharan mm-hmm. book trade. So it's very interesting, because Sudan is at the same time, someone once described it to me, Arabic in the context of Sudan as both a colonized language and the language of the colonizer. And, you know, is it part of the Middle East? Is it part of Africa? So how do you specifically orient Sudan? Is it Arab? Is it Arabophone? Is it Middle Eastern? Is it intersectional? Like what sort of identity do you think gives Sudan and the people who identify with Sudan agency?
Yeah, and I think that's a great question and a complex question. And we should perhaps clarify that though we are using the word Sudan And when we talk about it in the past, Sudan is one large country. It now exists as two countries, right? Sudan, the Republic of Sudan, which is the northern portion, and then the Republic of South Sudan, which became independent in 2011. But right, historically, Sudan is this sort of complicated territory that doesn't really fit neatly into academic categories, geographic categories. So that the portion that the book focuses on and that I study is the central region and the northern region, and which was the most dominant of the two. And they certainly have an Arab identity, right? Arabic is their lingua franca. So for those, right, so for people in northern Sudan, they probably don't have a relationship with the Arabic language as sort of a colonizer language, which I think is a great description, right, of the sort of the larger internal politics of Sudan. But I really, what draws me to it is this sort of marginal borderland quality, right, that it is at the intersection of all these different trade routes, right? So the ones that you've mentioned, there's a cloth trade. If we look east, there are trades with the Persian Gulf and the Indian Ocean. What drew me to Sudan is that it is this sort of uncomfortable space that its people has sort of had to work to sort of stake a claim and identity, right? And because it's on those margins, there seemed to be a flexibility for Sudanese people to say, we are Muslim, we speak Arabic, we are part of this Arabophone world, we are Middle Eastern, looking at Southern Sudan, no, we are something different. We have a different heritage. So I like the messy quality to it. And certainly when I describe myself as someone who studies the Middle East, and then they say, oh, what do you work on? And I say Sudan, you can sort of see people cataloging and scanning through their mental maps to figure out how Sudan, sort of fits or doesn't fit into what I say that I do. And I think that just opens up a lot of possibilities for historical inquiry, right? To look at these margins, to look at the places that don't fit perfectly into the categories that we've organized our lives around.
No, I definitely think they challenge our assumptions. And I think a lot of what this book did for me was, I mean, a lot of what I work on is Arabic language material. And I always like using that term because intellectual material, because I feel like it's more inclusive. Mm-hmm. And I feel that this book really hopefully will challenge that sense, because I often hear Sudan referred to as East African. I hear it referred to as North African, but then it complicates it. And I think, again, I think your book really forces us to take the agency of the individuals involved seriously. And I think that you're not necessarily dealing with this, the oblique issue of Sudanese identity, but I think sort of implicitly you're asking us to take these people seriously as actors. So sort of tangentially related to the question of agency, one thing that's really interesting about Sudan is the colonial relationship, because there's a description at some point in the book of Sudan is sort of where they sent athletic, the British sent athletic wrestlers. Also, it's co-administrated. You have the role of the Egyptians. So is that sort of an accurate assumption that sort of colonialism in Sudan is just very unique? And also, I was wondering about the question of race, because that's something else that sort of muddles our idea of what fits into the Middle East.
Yeah. So Sudan does have a strange colonial a strange sort of colonial sort of setup. So first of all, it was never officially declared a colony. And so it's ruled out of the Foreign Office as opposed to the Colonial Office. And that may make no difference for anyone other than a historian, but that means that it was sort of subject to different ideas and different understandings about what people were doing there. And you're absolutely right that it is jointly colonized by both Great Britain and Egypt, who in Egypt itself was colonized by England for much of this. So there's There's sort of a weird overlap and circular relationship going on. What ends up happening as is that neither the Egyptians nor the British are very comfortable with this relationship. And so they're always trying to sort of downplay the other's influence so that by the 1920s, you've sort of Great Britain and British civil administrators have reasserted their dominance. And Egypt is really just paying for the upkeep of this colony, but they've lost a lot of on the ground influence. And then as you point out, the British administrators who come out are not like others that belong to colonial civil service. So the line that was tossed around was that Sudan was a land of blacks ruled by blues. And blue is a reference to a sporting certificate that you get at Oxford or Cambridge when you win in particularly great matches. And the Sudan, the exam for the Sudan political service was notably easier than the one for India. Again, thinking about sort of margins and borderlands, right, that Sudan becomes this spot in which, not the best and the brightest go to, right, but the ones that have a sense of athleticism, that are looking for adventure, that, you know, don't want to have to sort of try too hard intellectually, they end up in this, sort of curious place called Sudan. So the race question, I want to make sure that I understand it. Do you mean race between perceived racial differences between Sudanese and Egyptians or Southern Sudanese and...
I suppose just the relationship between colonizers or hierarchies and black bodies specifically.
And frankly, I saw a lot less of that in Sudan. So, the British are fantastic in creating racial and ethnic categories. So that we see and we see the ways in which they come up with these really sort of descriptive understandings for ethnic attributes in places with a lot of sort of ethnic diversity. I'm thinking of India, for example. But in Sudan, there's less of a they draw sort of just two really distinct categories. There are those in the north who are Arab and Muslim. And then there are those in the south who are African and animist and potentially Christian. And so they certainly do treat Southern Sudanese slightly differently. They hold up the sort of nostalgia of a return to a tribe, the sort of the noble savage where sort of have a mythology around that and the way that the British interact with the Northern Sudanese is worried that they, it's sort of a defensive posture, right? Worried that they are going to be sort of radicalized by their Arab Muslim neighbors to the north. And so there is a sort of a protector quality that develops in which the British try and protect Southern Sudanese from the undue influence of the north.
So to the book itself, one of the delights of reading it were was the chapter titles, which reference different thawb patterns. So to give an example of one, it's one is the post office pen. And then the other is the schoolmistress's ribs. And the thawb in the Sudanese context, please correct me if I'm wrong, refers to the cloth that women wrapped around themselves.
That's correct. Yes.
Yeah. So to be clear, this book isn't simply about the thawb, but it's about the intersection of fashion and body in the context of women's history. It's an imperial history. It's Sudanese history. But what really stands out about the book is how you also read textiles as texts and how the thawb sort of weaves in and out of these themes. So I was wondering if you could sort of give us an introduction to the thawb and our sense of its emergence and its place in Sudanese history.
Yeah. And so the thawb itself, for your listeners, you can sort of envision it's very much like an Indian woman's sari. So it's simply a rectangular length of fabric that women are wrapping around their bodies and then throwing sort of over their heads. And it's an outer garment. It's meant for modesty to shield women and girls when they're out in public or in the company of unrelated men. And the thawb itself it means bolts of cloth. So in some ways, it gets sort of particularly difficult to track when you're thinking about imports, exports, and that kinds of thing. But it's we can trace its history back to late 18th, early 19th century, and it begins as a garment for elite women, wives of merchants who are involved in these regional sort of expansive trades, and it's a piece of presentation, right, and display to wear these sorts of fine cloths around you, which hint at sort of the distances that these materials have had to travel. Over the course of the 19th century, there is a religious proto-nationalist movement that sweeps through much of northern Sudan, and accompanied with that are much more conservative, strict interpretations of Islam and sex segregation. And so more and more women begin adopting the tobe or are compelled to adopt modest clothing like the tobe. And so the story really, the book really starts as the tobe has become sort of a recognized garment for married women. And what the book then tracks is the way in which the tobe goes from a utilitarian garment to something that is much more fashionable with all sorts of different changing styles and trends. But then also the way that the tobe is picked up as a garment that schoolgirls are wearing on their ways to school, right? So these are now young unmarried girls who are picking up this particular fashion and using it as a means of accessing educational opportunities. And then you, of course, have mentioned what I think is sort of the most fascinating part is that each of these tobe styles have names because they are these sort of simple rectangular lengths of fabric. They are most often white in the time period that we're talking about. And they will have patterns perhaps of polka dots or stripes, but these patterns are white on white patterns. And so a way to distinguish a new style is to give it a name. And the names are incredibly evocative, right? So the schoolmistress's ribs, which celebrates a rise of girls' education, and it was a striped tobe. So the stripes are, you know, mimicking this sort of ribbed quality. And the schoolmistress's ribs actually echoes an earlier tobe called the doctor's ribs, which came out in 1928 to celebrate first graduating class of Sudanese men from the Gordon Medical College. So that there is often these moments in which you can sort of really clearly date a tobe style to an event or a contemporary issue that's happening. And that's how I get to sort of reading textiles as text, right? So that we don't have evidence of, we don't have much evidence of Sudanese women talking about the importance of schooling or education, but we do have tobes, right, that reference notions of education and that are celebrating education. And so I've tried to do that, you know, without reading too much into it, but as you suggest, right, that this is the way that I find women's voices, this is the way that I find agency. In how they are naming these styles of their everyday dress.
Well, another example that I loved was, which I mentioned, was the post office pen.
Yeah.
And what I loved about it was that I don't think you're overreading into anything when you say that, well, the post office pen refers to, it's a dotted fabric, I believe, right? There's dots along the fabric, and it refers to the, I mean, it's sort of ubiquitous in the United States, sort of the chain with little balls
right
on it that we see at different places like a post office. So you don't take the pen away
right
with you. And that to me just felt so like such a concrete example of how the imperial relationship was being seen, how perhaps different hierarchies were being seen. It was just so well done because it referenced something that did come with the colonial context. So on that note, sort of often women and their place in society in the colonial context are seen as markers of civilization in reference to the mm-hmm. colonizer. So I'm curious, how did the British seek to civilize Sudan and how did this differ? Because we've been talking a lot about how unique Sudan was. And I'm curious whether or not the policies of the colonizer, particularly toward women, were affected by the British's sense of what Sudan was.
Right. So again, here we get to a little bit about where Sudan is unique in that British administrators are worried about uprising and sort of a nationalist movement. The reason they come into Sudan in the first place is to put down this nationalist rebellion. And so they make sort of a gentleman's agreement with Orthodox religious leaders in Sudan, saying that the British are not going to challenge personal status codes, right, or Sudanese culture. So they're not going to sort of directly challenge things like marriage, child custody, divorce, things having to sort of do with the family. And by extension, right, they're not going to, they're also not going to sort of evangelize in the north. And a lot of that, right, gets sort of wrapped up with domestic life and thus sort of women's spheres, sort of women's culture, right? So that in some ways the British are very much hands off, but these you know imperialists are absolutely operating in a moment in which the strength and civility of a nation is absolutely judged by the status of its women, and so the British intervene in two ways. One, which we've already sort of hinted at, is education, right? And so they set up formal education for girls along sort of Western lines. And it's not huge or expansive. I mean, it certainly could have been larger. But they do that. And this is something that the Sudanese population as a whole is sort of very interested in, educating their girls. We have incidents of... So the ways that you got in, there were a number of different ways to get into these schools, but one of which was just sort of clearly age, right? If you were the right age and there was an opening in the fourth form or the third form, your daughter could perhaps go in. But because girls don't have birth certificates, or many of them didn't, age was sort of judged on, you know, how many sort of adult teeth or baby teeth a girl had in her mouth at any one time. And parents were known to lie about or sort of be deceptive in the age of their daughters because they just wanted them in school. And so this was a program that many Sudanese were very much in favor of. But the other way, the other sort of major thrust of sort of the British civilizing mission was in the arena of female genital cutting. So in Sudan, they practice one of the most extreme forms of female genital cutting known as infibulation, in which the labia major and minor and the clitoris is removed. The remaining flesh is stitched closed, leaving only a small hole for urine and menses to pass through. And when the British learned about this, they were sort of absolutely horrified and thought that this was sort of an incredible degradation of women. And they set out, they established a midwifery program to train midwives in Western biomedicine, but also to establish sort of new standards of what reproductive health looks like, and that a reproductive body would not be a circumcised body. They largely fail in this attempt, but these are sort of the two threads of sort of shaping minds through education, but then also a very sort of concentrated attempt in changing what a woman's body looked like, right, and in the most intimate way, specifically what genitalia of a civilized woman would look like.
One thing I think that's interesting about the relationships between the colonized and the colonizer is that oftentimes the colonizer might not understand different forms of political expression. And one form I think of constantly is clothing. So I grew up in the West Bank, I'm Palestinian. And during the 1930s, during the Great Arab Revolt in 1936, we reframed a lot of our clothing and our music in order to sort of code political messages into them as forms of resistance. And that's an example from the Palestinian context. But I was wondering, does this manifest in the Sudanese context?
So certainly clothing is political in the ways that it talks back and references particular moments. So some other examples of toe names, as the 1950s progresses and the nationalist movement takes off, there are names such as Freedom, Independence, the Republic, the Diplomatic Corps, right, which anticipates the arrival of foreign embassies. But this resistive quality or this anti-imperialist quality, I think, is less apparent than something that I really thought about in terms of the taupe as functioning as a way of establishing a sense of place in a wider world and marking out a territory of belonging. And so what I see is not so much the sort of direct activist sort of pushback against imperialism, but clothing as a way of, and the taupe specifically, as a way of claiming a spot in this world that is changing, right, as empire sort of begins to wane. And this gets back in some ways to what you were thinking about with the post office pen, right, as an excitement or an interest in imperial infrastructures, right, like a postal system, the education that's required to sort of send a letter to someone, and then also the sort of imaginative longing of that there was someone to receive a letter and perhaps write back. And I found that this then results in a more complicated story, right? It's not just, I'm thinking of, sort of Gandhi's homespun cloth movement, right? Of we're wearing this particular type of clothing as a protest of imperial power. Egypt has something very similar in which you have to, with nylon stockings, and you're supposed to wear nylon stockings that have been produced within Egypt. And I think what Sudanese women do is more complex, right? In that it's not so much sort of nationalist as imaginative. And I think that has sort of really strong political implications as well.
No, I think that definitely, I mentioned earlier that I think the book gives a lot of agency to its actors. And I think that's another way in which sort of you muddling these senses of what resistance is or what political conversation is or engagement with the colonizer, I think you've really given a lot of agency to these characters. So sort of to bring it back to a more micro level, the body and fashion are separate in sort of the title of the book, Fashion and Body Politics in Imperial Sudan, but they're very inextricably linked. So what is the relationship of clothing to the body, both in the abstract, but also in the Sudanese imperial case?
Yeah, that's great. And you picked up on something that I didn't even think about, right? And that my title treats them as separate things. I think I just liked the cadence of two things. And also I had a different word in there and the publisher didn't like it, so we had to... Anyway, so in some sense, right, that clothing is an extension of the body, right, and in the ways that our skin expresses certain things, right, the clothing as sort of our outer layer expresses, again, sort of notions of place, belonging, what community do I belong to, what class do I belong to, what gender do I belong to. And so in that sense, they are sort of linked and perhaps treated as one unit. What's different, though, and this is perhaps a very obvious point, is that fashion is so much more malleable than the flesh, right, than the body itself. So one of the things the Sudanese women historically had sort of marked their bodies in particular ways. There had been tattooed lips, and these were done to sort of enhance beauty on the eve of a woman's wedding. Cheek scars were also carved into the cheeks of actually both boys and girls, and these were to indicate tribal affiliations, but also again as marks of sort of beauty and something appealing. And as the 20th century progresses, as urban life becomes sort of more pronounced and urban culture becomes the dominant culture, these kinds of body marks fall away. However, you know, if your body has already been tattooed or scarred in a particular way, you can't get rid of those marks. But what you can do, right, is change the kind of clothing that you're wearing, or change the meanings that are given to the clothing that you're wearing. And in some senses, over the 20th century, women's use of the toe is constant and is expanded, as I mentioned, out into young girls. But there's not, you know, there's not a debate on, oh, should we be wearing different types of clothing? In contrast, Sudanese men, a split in many ways, sort of along class lines and education lines, between whether they take up sort of the Western suits that mimic British civil servants, or whether they retain the sort of the galabeah like robes that are more traditional. And so fashion allows for sort of a choice in political expression and social expression that the body sometimes is not, right? There's a stubbornness to flesh. There's a permanency to our flesh that we can't always change. One other thing that I sort of raise in the book, and I haven't fully pieced out or pulled out because at that time I just didn't have sort of the words for it, and I'm still working on finding them. There's also just a sensual quality to the act of putting on clothes, right? And to put on a fine imported fabric as opposed to something rough spun or lower class. And so I think that there's also a sensory aspect to draping your body in something called, so there's a sensory aspect to A, just draping your body in a fabric. But then to connect that fabric with a name like the schoolmistress's ribs or independence, I haven't quite figured out the sort of the affective connection between these names of political expression, political conversation, and the feeling of draping one's body in that garment. So that's something that I'm still trying to piece together and find out how to talk about sort of cogently.
Well, that's actually part of my next question, which is, I mean, you talk about sort of how the body feels against fabric and how that, but also there's this issue of motion, because there's how you wrap something mm-hmm. around your body, but then also how you carry yourself when you're draped in this, yes. in this fabric, when you're wearing a certain aspect of clothing. So tied into that, so motion is very much part of this book is, as you mentioned, the thob is outerwear. It's something that allows women to move comfortably mm-hmm. within their settings. And we spend a lot of time in two particular settings, so Khartoum and Omdurman, which are two urban settings, two cities in northern Sudan, northern Imperial Sudan. And I was curious, sort of, how did you see motion and urban settings and female bodies sort of all linked together? How do they impact one another?
Right. And so you're absolutely right that the toe is allows for mobility in ways that sort of hadn't been permitted before, because it takes the enclosure and protection of the harem and makes it sort of mobile. But this also means, and here we get back to sort of education, is that the imperial period brings new opportunities for movement. So those are girls going to school, midwives attending cases farther and farther afield, nurses, teachers. We eventually have activists. So that women are just not only moving their bodies in different ways, but moving into new spaces. And there's sort of a dangerous quality to this. So the book touches on a number of instances in which women are yelled at or sort of actually beaten because they are out in public in ways that men sort of believe they shouldn't be. And another thing, a lot of this came to me as I tried to sort of move my own body through Sudan in the 21st century, right? And the ways in which I tried to sort of navigate streets, navigate the heat, navigate modesty, right? And things that were sort of expected of a woman of my class. And so that really sort of brought home to me, right, that the act of going to school or the act of participating in a protest march or attending a public meeting was really a form of labor, right? And there's dirt and there's dust and there's heat and there's sort of jostling. And that all of that would have been sort of really significant experiences for women whose lives had largely been circumscribed by the home at that point. And then I should also just sort of say, so the tobe, because it is a wrapped garment, there's no fastenings, there's no ties or snaps. And so to do this walk, you have to hold your elbows and your shoulders and your hips in a really sort of particular way so that the tobe doesn't fall off, right? I was at a meeting in which a woman wearing a tobe was attempting to serve tea. It was a public-ish space, semi-public space. The choreography or orchestrations of her body to keep herself modest and also, pour out tea and serve it. There was an incredible sort of body knowledge that had to happen. In order to keep her sort of wrapped and clothed in an appropriate way. So that's an incredibly tiny example. But then when you expand that out, you see how this would have been sort of, that women sort of across Sudan would have been experiencing this. And in fact, there are observations from a number of British civil servants who are involved in girls' education who note that, it was sort of painful, but also rather sort of funny to watch these young girls wrapped in these large tobes, sort of attempting to make their way to school, right? That they would sort of trip and fall and would drag along the ground. Because to make these movements required training your body and holding your body in new ways.
I really like that point because I think it really draws our attention to, it's a universal-ish point. You can sort of apply that to our modern day and age and think about fashion, style, and as you mentioned, class and identity, and sort of use our own bodies as case studies or the bodies of our friends and use that to create empathy. So I think that's a really powerful point, even though I think the British colonial officers had an interesting perspective on it, to say the least. Another great example from the book of sort of how the thobe could be how women had to adopt a certain way of being within the thobe is a political activist you mentioned. I believe it's Nafisa Ahmed Al-Amin. She's at a political meeting, I think, and she realizes no one can hear her, and she removes part of her thobe from where it's covering part of her mouth, from where it's obstructing her speech. And then she makes her point, she's heard, and then she just, very calmly puts it back, sort of rewraps herself properly. And I really enjoyed that because I think that again, gave agency to her as an individual and doesn't necessarily see the tobe as constricting, but rather as something that we learn to wear, as with all of our clothing, that we learn to wear clothing.
I just want to sort of interject in that moment. So Nafisa Ahmed El-Amin is sort of a lovely, lively woman. And when she told me that story, she actually acted it out. And I thought that was so powerful, right? Sort of current Sudan, the tobe is not worn to cover the mouth. But in our normal conversations, the tobe was not covering her mouth. But then to act out the sort of historical moment at a time in which the tobe did cover the mouth, right? So she, to sort of act this out, so she first rearranges her tobe so that her mouth is covered. And then she shows me how she removed it and then puts it back on. And when she finished telling the story, she just laughed and laughed and laughed. And it was so powerful to see that moment of, sort of, as you say, sort of learning our bodies and learning our clothing. And I think, you know, she's also laughing at that, I think, sort of the ridiculousness of it all, perhaps, with hindsight. But also, you know, the fact that she thought it was really important to show me how that worked, right? That sort of literal veiling and unveiling and then veiling back again was such a sort of a wonderful moment. That again clued me in to the ways in which what I was trying to tell was a story about bodies moving in new ways.
It's funny because I think that those things, I want to get into the question of sources mm-hmm. in a moment. It's really those things that stick with you. Sometimes you forget meetings you have, sometimes you forget, you know, I don't know, a book you read, but you do kind of remember what it was like to wear these little mundane mm-hmm. or everyday things, like what it was like to wear something and how it feels against you. And I think that's really powerful that stuck out in her memory. It seems like that's what stuck out in her memory, perhaps more than what she said. But I also think that was not the point of the interview with her. I wanted to ask the question of sources, because I think one thing you illustrate, which is almost a universal fact, is it's very difficult to get women's voices before a certain period. Mm-hmm. And you do this so well, and you go into people's homes. Like there's this whole section of the book where you describe what happens when people do their hair and the different types of braids. Mm-hmm. And then I think another thing you're very oblique about, and rightfully so, is that there are disciplinary prejudices that we're used to reading certain sources in certain ways. And you actually quote again Nafisa, the activist, a student activist, Nafisa Ahmed El-Amin, and reference her knowledge that women were politically aware and that there are different types of political expression and that there are different ways of engaging with one's society and one's politics. So I guess it's a bit of a twofold question I'm trying to ask you, which is how do you determine whether certain sources exist, and how do you repurpose existing sources? Sort of what's the creative mindset that you bring to it?
Yeah, so I wish I'd had the luxury of determining and choosing sources. I felt like I was just sort of grabbing anything I could possibly get. And that might be a larger story about the archives and things like that. But So the sources that I used are broad and not necessarily, particularly imaginative, right? So official and personal papers of British civil servants, women's journals, interviews, photographs, memories, anthropological accounts, and I think these are all at this point sort of par for the course. And I guess what I had to sort of get comfortable with was, we exist in the world of sort of reading against the grain and, recognizing sort of implicit bias and things like that in sources. And I had to get comfortable with what I didn't know. And also, Ann Stoller, sort of uses the term of sort of reading with the grain, right? And perhaps sort of also trusting that many of my authors were sort of being as honest as possible about sort of their own experiences, right? What I ended up doing, though, was reading for bodies. And I think that this is my sort of larger methodological or disciplinary call, which is to recognize moments of movement in our sources, to recognize periods of action or the actual physicalness of the characters and the agents that we're talking about. And so I think that's what I believe I've done differently. And that's sort of my larger call, is that we can use the very limited sources that we have and sort of approach them in a new way. And figure out that sort of the underlying, I guess, sort of tangible quality of the experience that they're trying to describe. So for an example, one source I used was a British civil servant complaining that her midwives should be afforded a better travel class pass than they had been given. So Sudanese midwives were traveling in third class on trains and such, and she wanted them to travel second class. So this is, sort of a bureaucratic moment. But what she lays out is the difficulties of traveling in third class, that it's cold, it's cramped. When you come to a station, third class passengers have to exit the car, whereas second class passengers can stay in the car. And so this is, bureaucratic sort of minutiae that nobody would really care about, but what I was interested in then was the experience of the bodies, right? The women's bodies in these cramped cars, traveling at night, having to exit and then re-enter. And so that's what I looked for in terms of mining, right? Sort of taking moments and looking for the body, the action, the movement underneath.
So to close the interview, I'm really curious, what are you working on right now? What other sorts of projects are you pursuing?
Yeah, so I am working on a new project that remains sort of focused on bodies and the intimacy of imperial experience, but I'm shifting my focus to British women and civil servants in Sudan in the first half of the 20th century. And I'm looking at their romantic and sexual adventures. And so I'm approaching Sudan as this, again, this really important liminal or marginal space in which British female imperialists in their public lives are teachers or nurses. But in their private lives, they're really taking advantage of this marginal social positioning of Sudan to pursue, flirtations and moments of play and to sort of act out romantic and sexual desires that don't conform to Victorian notions of civility. And so I sort of early days yet, but I have a number of sort of enticing leads and enticing characters. And the goal is sort of to reconstruct the imperial landscape in Sudan and to recast female imperialists as unpredictable actors, right? Who straddle being both public models of civility, but also desirous subjects, right? And desiring subjects who are asserting an authority over their bodies.
That sounds like such a multifold project. I don't want to call it a productive project because to some extent that's a bit of a dirty word sometimes, but it's such a layered project that's going to perhaps be another great exercise in storytelling. I mentioned to you before the interview that this book, Khartoum at Night, is particularly great because it just reads like a story and it makes all these great methodological points, but in such wonderful prose.
Thank you.
So I'm sure that's going to be another case because you seem to really have a knack for picking out characters and these little nuggets for readers to latch onto and attach concepts to. So congratulations on the book. It's really a great achievement.
Oh, well, thank you so much. And I appreciated all of your comments and questions.
Oh, and thank you so much for doing the interview with me.